Now, before I proceed this afternoon to the introduction of the panel, it is my great honor and privilege to call on Dave B. of Montreal, who has a most present duty to perform. I present to you Dave B.
Thank you, good people. It's a wonderful thing to be here. And it's an even more wonderful thing to me that I happen to have been the one who has been chosen to make a presentation to Bill on behalf of all the Canadian AA. As I have no doubt every single person in this room knows, that Bill is the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous and the original AA member. And to me, he is and always has been a friend and an advisor. And I have had always a special feeling for GSO and the people down there, because that is where I got AA from. It came to me first in a letter from a girl named Bobby, quite a long time ago. And there were letters from Bill. And when I was able to get down there, I went down and visited them and visited Bill and Lois. And this was a tremendous experience to me. It was like, I guess, in those very early days, a pilgrimage to Mecca. And that's what they used to say in Montreal. There's old Dave going down on his pilgrimage to Mecca. And it hasn't changed too much over these years. It seems to me if one is to think about the beginnings of Alcoholics Anonymous, one must arrive, and I don't see how one can escape from it, that some guiding force had a hand in arranging the sequence of events that brought AA into being. It couldn't all be just coincidence, or so it seems to me. Certainly the hand of destiny was in it. And it was Bill who set the whole train of events in motion, and who, by so doing, with such dedicated and devoted service, gave us what we have today. And I have 10 minutes, and so let's look back a little bit to how this thing came about, to the original alcoholic from upstate New York who, finding no way to get sober and becoming desperate, went over to Switzerland to see the great Dr. Jung. And after a course of treatment, he left there full of high hope. This was the answer. I think every one of us also in this room knows about what in the big book Bill called the insane impulse. And before he found himself at the channel to take the boat home, this man got drunk and he went back to Dr. Jung. And Dr. Jung told him the only thing he knew was for him to try to find a spiritual awakening. And he came back to New York, and he got in touch with another tremendous friend of AA, Sam Shoemaker, who's now dead, God bless him. And he got involved with the Oxford group. And it was there that Ebby got sober. And you all remember the story of Ebby appearing in Bill's kitchen. And later on, appearing in Towns Hospital, where another tremendous friend of AA's was Dr. Silkworth, who was a tremendous friend of Bill, and the miraculous recovery of Bill. And nobody really at least can tell me that all of this was mere coincidence. And then Bill's trip to Akron and the meeting with Dr. Bob. And then old Bill Dotson. This was how AA began. And after a while, it spread to Canada. You know, now we're all back in the birthplace of AA in Canada. It came here, really. I have to be careful, a lot of Toronto people here. It came here, really, in my memory at least, and before my memory from what I heard. It came really in the form of the Oxford group movement. I can remember some of the people around here in Ontario had sobriety medallions that were older than Bill Wilson's sobriety. But then there was another man. He's dead now, God bless him. His name was George Little. And George was an ardent temperance worker. But George did get a little bit of what AA was. And he did some tremendous work. He was a man that many of you heard what he said, and he told me, and I never have forgotten, that fate follows faith. Desire is destiny. And I can remember in my earliest days in AA, there used to be two kinds of groups down here in Toronto. There were the God groups and the no-God groups. You take your pick, and they didn't talk to each other too much. I think I'm getting a little on in years now. In fact, I know it, and I'm beginning to feel it a little bit. And I think of the old prophecy that your young men shall see visions and your old men shall dream dreams. Bill has always been a man of great vision. And as AA's growth and progress and present structure has shown, he has worked and he has fought for it. And now perhaps we can take just a very short look back to dream a few dreams of which I hope my gray hairs entitle me. Bill used to tell his story a great deal more often than he does now. And to tell you the truth, I wish he still did. Because to me this was one of the most tremendously inspirational stories that we have in AA, and any of you who have heard it will know it. And sometimes I think back to my very own earliest days in AA. And as I said, I got my AA in New York, and I got it from the book that Bill wrote. And I can remember that in this country at that time there were a few struggling few of us in far distantly separated parts of the country. And I can remember that promise in the end of the chapter, a vision for you. And the promise was, if you be but one lone man with this book in your hand, that you can have friends galore and everything will work out for you. And the answer was, but I can't do that. I'm jittery and I'm afraid and I'm alone. And then it went on to say, but you forget. You forget that you've just now tapped a source of power so much greater than yourself. And sometimes we did. And as I sit sometimes in my garden and I think of the thousands upon thousands of home where peace and freedom and love has come back. I think of all this with a tremendously grateful heart. And I sometimes say to myself, what if he had tried to keep it? What if he had tried to keep it for himself? And all we can do is thank God that he did, that he handed it on to us. And by the grace of God, while I happened to be your servant as a trustee, the Canadian trustee, I had the wonderful opportunity of visiting every general service region in Canada. And it is from all of these people, because this thing represents us all, that I am going to present a bill on your behalf. From the bottom of our hearts, Bill, to express our very great gratitude and to wish you and Lois the very best, and God bless you and thank you.
God bless you.
I hope you do.
Dear friends, this inscription reads, in gratitude to Bill, from all Canadian members of AA, 30th Anniversary, International Convention, Toronto, Ontario, Canada, July 1965. May I endeavor to express the feeling which those simple words evoke. I know this is a testament of your gratitude and of your love. At this moment, one of the great moments in my life, I would not exchange places with anyone else in the world. At this moment, or at any other moment, although your testament of gratitude bears the label to Bill, may I presume to read a larger intention into what you have done. I first think of Dr. Bob, my earliest partner in this benign enterprise. I think of his labor of love, as with Sister Ignatia at Akron. Between 1940 and 50, he ministered to some 5,000 of us who had suffered, thereby becoming if titles are appropriate, the Prince of the 12th Step. And if you like, the dear sister, the Princess. So these kept the faith and left us a legacy of experience in which the actual performance of our 12th step is today rooted. And I think of that period when AA flew blind and no one could say what shape we might take, if indeed any shape would be forthcoming. In those first years, we were ever so frail. We could have perished in our infancy. So at that time, especially, the difference between life and death for us and all who have come in these years was made by the handful, the few score of those who were able to keep the faith, to keep the candle burning when great winds might have caused it to gutter out. So I would rather believe, and I'm confident, that you will accept my view that in a deeper sense, this token of love and affection has been designed and presented in remembrance of all those who did keep the faith in yesteryear. I simply say thank you. This occasion may be a most fitting hour in which to present you a besetting problem of yesteryear. You are all, I am sure, familiar with the history of the development of anonymity, how the name came from the book title, which in turn came from our characterization that we were a nameless bunch of drunks trying to get along after we left the protection of our friends in the Oxford group. So nameless grew into anonymity. And our anonymity was at first spurred by not so much any profundity or nobility indeed. The stigma on us people in those days was immense. We thought we had to be a secret society. Then again, we thought when publicity came and some of our members naturally ran to the media of communication, the microphones, and began to proclaim the message from the housetops, that was a natural, a normal, a well-meaning thing. But the altitude for some was too great. The air was too exhilarating up there. And still meaning well, they began to say, but now I am also allied with enterprises X, Y, and Z. Wonderful works all. How about some money and publicity for all these? And because we were bent on a quest for survival, where nothing but the best would do, anyone could foresee great complications and distractions for us if this happened. So we began to talk about anonymity at the public level. And I suppose it wasn't until 1950, or shortly thereafter, at about the time 12 and 12 was done, and we began to ask ourselves what these traditions, particularly the 12th, really meant, did we realize that in our anonymity, God had offered us an unbounded opportunity which went far beyond protection? As you remember, the first tradition of AA says that the common welfare must come first. Well, anonymity is an earnest and a practice of that principle, because if we are anonymous at the top public level, we forego even natural and legitimate aspirations to win fame and fortune by the use of the AA name. After all, each of us is living on borrowed time. Nothing but the best will do. So each of us, in the spirit of anonymity, has foreclosed his chance to win public recognition by the use of the AA name. Now then, this tradition, as it came into view in this great dimension, brought a very special burden upon Dr. Bob and me. And not long before he died, I was out there, and in a rather humorous way, tinged with gratitude to be sure, he said that one of his local AA friends, an undertaker, had been up there, and he had brought a sketch with him of an appropriate mausoleum suitable to a founder and his wife, in which Dr. Bob might be incarcerated when he kicked off with cancer. Well, Dr. Bob grinned and looked at me and said, what do you think? Well, I didn't think, so Bob said it. Why in God's name don't you and I get buried like other folks? That was the beginning of our compact. That was an extension of the principle of anonymity And presently, there were other laudable honors offered us, suitable indeed and necessary to the world outside, but not really appropriate to our needs. Each of us had offers from universities for degrees of various sorts. Well, this was very stirring. The community around us was saying, we accept this society as useful citizens of the world, and these honors that we proffer to its originators are a token of this. But we decline, explaining our special need that I have just pointed out. After Dr. Bob died, and we grew in public esteem and knowledge, I began to be offered more of the same. My own college, where I had been a flop, thought that I should have a degree. There was the convenient excuse that the World War Service had sort of cut off my chances at school, which I never would have finished anyhow. Well, that's too facetious. They were very serious about this, and so was I. So, again, I explain. However, there came an opportunity which brought me a great temptation. And I thank God for the memory of the compact I made with Dr. Bob. And I thank God for the people who then reminded me of it. And this is how it happened. The background here was an offer of the Lasker Award. The Lasker Award is given for those making outstanding contributions in the medical field, and I think in others. It is a citation of very large distinction. One out of each five of its recipients have received the ultimate prize at Stockholm. Well, it wasn't too hard to turn this one down because in this case the award could be given to our society as a whole. We could have one of our dear non-alcoholic boards, members of our trustees, go out there to the San Francisco Opera House, which was to be packed to the rafters with the public and the local AAs, and receive this award on the behalf of our whole society. This was a very different thing than the taking of personal honors. And I was glad to be there on the stage and to stand up and say a brief thank you on behalf of AAs everywhere. I'm sure this was quite right. Then came the real temptation. One day, acting for the Board of Trustees of Yale University, an old friend of mine and a friend of the secretary up there came into my office and he said, the board would like to give you a degree seldom accorded in universities of our size and standing, the greatest degree that a layman can have, the Doctor of Law. I cannot portray to you my mixed emotions. You see, there were two sides of this coin. Not humility on one side and pride on the other. There were very practical results which could flow from either course. Because were I to say no to this, I might be doing a lot of people great harm. I would be in a company of distinguished men. In the eyes of the average citizen, it would increase our standing. It would result in considerable publicity. And it would attract a great many people to AA. Conceivably several thousand. Were I to say no, I would be literally pronouncing a sentence of death because of the lack of this publicity on some of our fellow sufferers, and the miseries of countless others would be prolonged. Moreover, let's face it, one toyed with the idea of a trip to Stockholm. Please don't record this in the press, if any of you reporters are absent. This is a kind of a private sharing, if you like. So I was of 2 months. And I continued to mull this thing. And the first impulse of our Board of Trustees was, no matter what you think, AA cannot go without this asset. But one of our trustees, whose father was a great and one-time president of the U.S., looked across the table and said, he, Bill, I don't want to exert any special influence on your decision. This is for you. I would just like to put a fact in the hopper. He said, heavens knows, my father was a public figure. Far less anonymous than the New York Yankees. But as a protection against himself, he always declined personal honor. This made a deep, deep impression upon me. And I did remember Dr. Bob. So, on your behalf, I hope I am right. I said no. I said this because I think that in this unusual world of anonymity, we can discover spiritual values of still undisclosed work. And in it, this society can be protected from ourselves. When ourselves are on the rampage, and I must here note that my rampages have been considerable. So I leave you with this fragment of AA history, about which I have never spoken so frankly before, lest you conclude that I am guilty of the worst kind of spiritual pride, boasting of my humility. Now this is something different. This is an intimate testament from my brothers and sisters in this world kinship. And it is their expression symbolizing their gratitude and their love, not only for me, but for those several others of our early time who even better kept the faith.
By your presence, as always. Here's your little card, Bill. This, I am sure you will all agree, has been a heartwarming experience. And on your behalf, as well as on behalf of all members of the Fellowship in Canada, I desire to thank Dave B. of Montreal for the graceful eloquence with which he presented our humble tribute to Bill, and also to Bill for the typical generosity and humility with which he received our equally humble gift. We of Alcoholics Anonymous in Canada are many thousands of men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Alcohol being no respecter of persons, we are an accurate cross-section of the realm of Canada, representing as we do all trades, professions, classes, and creeds. To show you that we are average Canadians, all sections of Canada and many of its occupations are represented today on this platform, as well as many racial, political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds. We are normally people who would not mix, but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement that binds us, but that in itself could never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and on which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. And so your committee has brought to this platform today a member of our fellowship from each and every province and territory of this vast realm of Canada. They will today on this platform tell you of the first great legacy that our honored founders gave us. By a happy circumstance, there are 12 territories and provinces in Canada. Therefore, each of our speakers will deal with one of the steps until the 12 steps of recovery have all been covered. Our first speaker, who will speak on step one, comes from that beautiful province of British Columbia, where sea and sky, mountain and forest, blend to produce scenery unrivaled on this continent. This lovely lady belongs to the center group in New Westminster, British Columbia. And if you think that scenery in British Columbia is limited to mountain, sea, and forest, wait until you see the young lady whom I now present. I give you Donna Dean.
Everyone, I must say, because I like to say it, my name is Donna, and I am an alcoholic. This is the step that I have been chosen to speak on. I have no notes. I don't know what I'm going to say, but I do know that what I do say is a message that will come truly from my heart, because step one to me was a tremendous thing that happened in my life that changed my life into something worthwhile. I suppose in order to interpret this step, I shall put it in the first person. Our step is we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. In my case, my life had become unmanageable long before I admitted that I was an alcoholic and that I was powerless over alcohol. I suppose I must, too, tell a small bit of my story in that it does deal, in this step. A little of the history should be mentioned. I did not realize I was an alcoholic, and when I say this, I don't say it because I was hiding, as we do. I was unfortunate enough to have what they say, in the medical parlance, delayed DTs and hallucinations, in that I would go on these periodic benders and with great willpower stop drinking, make a million promises, and 5 or 6 days later I would go into these terrible spasms or seizures or whatever you want to call them. I won't dwell on those too much, but suffice to say that for 2 years before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I spent my leisure time, you might say, when I wasn't drinking, in and out of psychopathic wards and hospitals. I can laugh about this now. There were a lot of humorous things I could tell, but time does not permit it. And we all know the weird things we can do when we're under the influence of alcohol. I would like to say that to me, When I came to realize that I was an alcoholic, this was a tremendous realization to me, because I truly had reached the point in my alcoholism, which I didn't recognize as such, I had reached the point of lost identity. I had woken in a hospital one time, strapped down to a bed, and I literally didn't know who I was. I thought I had dreamed my own life. This is a very terrifying thing, and I have never forgotten it, and I hope I never will forget it. I am one of these people that do not want to forget any of the things that have happened to me. I went all the way down the lonesome road of alcoholism, right to the very bottom. There was no further. I had nowhere else to go. I had reached a point of no return, of mental oblivion. I was fortunate in one sense that I did not lose materially. I say this because I've been able to help others since I came in through not being financially right down at the bottom. But mentally, morally, spiritually, I was nothing. I was truly a wreck of a woman. I may have looked much the same as I do now, but I was not the same, my friends. I had become a morbid, unhappy, I would say almost a manic depressive. I couldn't live with myself, and I didn't know why, and consequently no one else could live with me. I could stand here, I think, all day and talk to you about this, but I know I can't. But there's so much that I want to say. There's so much I would like to convey to all of you here. I would like to say this, that if there is one person in this room that maybe has admitted to alcoholism but has not accepted it, please accept it. I think this is the key to the freedom in AA, is acceptance. I also think, and these are my personal thoughts, that it is an emotional acceptance we have to reach. It isn't enough for the mind to admit and accept this point of alcoholism and the fact that we're alcoholics. I think that emotionally we have to accept this. We have to accept it wholeheartedly, with all our heart and soul. You know, this, some people, I guess, smile when I say this, but I mean this. My greatest fear when I came into AA was that I wasn't an alcoholic. In order to explain this, I mean, when you lived under the fear of insanity for 2 years and thought that you were going to be permanently confined eventually and woke every morning thinking, is this the day my mind is going to snap and I'm going to be put away, never to come out into the world again, to live like a vegetable? And suddenly something turned on in my mind and I thought, not I am an alcoholic, but could I be? Could I be an alcoholic? I hoped that I could be an alcoholic because this was hope for me. AA was hope for me. I read. I went into a sanitarium. I read all the literature I could find on it. And I was in AA, my friends, before I ever went to a meeting. And the first 3 months I was in AA, I used to be so terrified that something would happen that I would find out, and people would say, you're not an alcoholic, you can't stay here. Because I truly wanted to be one, because this was a way out, a way back to be a normal, youthful woman, a person who could come back into the society that I was raised in, to use the education that I had the fortune to be blessed with, to find a way of life again that I should have been living, but unbeknownst to myself, I couldn't live because I wasn't capable. I think that the basic truth to me in all of this great program, I guess we all have to take this first step in any road in life, no matter where we go, we have to take a first step. To me, this first step led to an open door with a new life that lay ahead of me, a life of sobriety, not only of body, I think this is fairly easy to achieve, as we all know, but a sobriety of mind. This is the thing that we all strive for, at least I do. I don't know how long I've gone along the road in this sobriety of mind. Sometimes the way I act, I'm a little dubious as to whether I've gone very far at all, but I am trying. And to be given this chance to try, this to me is one of the most... Well, I feel as though I'm a miracle standing here. I say this humbly. I met humility for the first time when I took the first step, I think. I had never known what the word meant before. Also, I had never known what the word gratitude meant before. I had taken everything for granted all my life. Why shouldn't I have everything? I was Donna. I don't know who I thought Donna was, but in my poor, sick mind at the time, I placed a great amount of importance on myself, and I now realize that I'm just a cog in the wheel along with all the rest of you. And if I could stand here and really tell you the gratitude that's in my heart to be here, the privilege that I think it is to be able to stand here, because without all of you people, I wouldn't be here. I would have had nowhere to go. There would have been no hope for me. And to me, to be literally returned from the dead, which I think I was, because I was dead in everything but body, this is truly, I feel, I am a small miracle. And I really don't know what else to say. As I say, I haven't timed myself. I just got up here, and I really opened my mouth, and I thought that the words would be put into my heart of what I would like to say to you. The gratitude, the fellowship, the communication that I have found here all came to me through taking this first step along this wonderful road of sobriety, which, God willing, I will never turn back from. I really am sincerely and truly grateful to be standing here. I really can't say any more. I'm sort of full, and I would like to thank you all, each and every one of you, from the bottom of my heart for my sobriety and for the privilege of being here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Donna, for a wonderful presentation. We now move over 3,700 miles across the realm of Canada to the Parkdale group of Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, whence we bring you a grateful and earnest member of the fellowship who will tell you about the second step. I present Mr. Ralph Ping.
Bill, friends, and fellow alcoholics. As your chairman mentioned, I am from the province of Prince Edward Island, and that is in the eastern part of Canada, and there was a little mix-up, I think, in my bookings into the hotel with myself and my family. They must have got me mixed up with some of the other islands down there, because when I checked into my room, there wasn't a stick of furniture in it. I have been asked to give my personal interpretation of the second step. Now, I have made a few notes, which I don't entirely agree on for myself. And if you will bear with me, I am going to try and tell you how I found the step. And there may be a little question after you hear the other speakers. Perhaps this man on the second step didn't get all his sanity yet. Through the teachings I had received from my parents as a child and young adult, I did not completely lose believing in a power greater than myself. Although through the use of alcohol and its effect on me, I had lost all reasoning and understanding of how to communicate and work with this power. And at times, there was a considerable amount of doubt on my part if there actually was a power. And the second step, perhaps I had forgot to read. I know you all know it here. I hope I do. I have it copied here somewhere. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Well, as I just mentioned, I did not have too much difficulty with the first part of this step. But the last three words in step two, restore me to sanity. Well, I could see some people at that time that were very close and near to me were becoming a little peculiar in their actions and what they used to tell me. But to think for a minute that I was insane was ridiculous. I even went so far as to trace back through my family, and I found no traces of insanity, particularly in myself. I felt at that time that I was very successful, very intelligent, and all that goes with it. In fact, I can recall one incident that I thought I was so clever that I had nearly succeeded, I guess only as an alcoholic can, in convincing my daughter that her mother was crazy. Well, anyone with ability to do this could not have too much insanity in them. Then, I wasn't quite satisfied with this word, sanity. I had put in insane there instead of sanity. And I looked up in a good book, the dictionary, and I listened to AA talks and coffee sessions, and I came out with this here. This is my own interpretation. Sanity, to me, is a strong and healthy mind. This I did not have. As I referred to a moment ago of some of my thoughts, I certainly wasn't very healthy in the upper part. So again, I read the step over, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to a sound and healthy mind. I had to work, and I had to work hard to get my mind healthy. And just the same as it took time to get my physical health back, and at times I feel that this is not going to be 100%, and there is a slight possibility that the other parts may not be 100% completed either. (Clears throat) I have left this little problem of health in the care of God's hands in the past and the present. And through doing this, I find that my outlook to myself and to my fellow man and to life itself has become much, much more healthier. And I think after working at this, I have came to the conclusion, for me, a disaster has turned into a blessing. And I often wonder what would have happened to me if it had not been for the second step, that I had the opportunity to have my mind restored or my sanity to health. I wouldn't have had the privilege to go on with the rest of the steps and our wonderful slogans and our wonderful AA prayer. Now, I, needless to say, am very nervous, and I am not going to continue too much longer, but this kind of reminds me of a chap I heard when someone asked him when he sat down how he felt. He said it was just like the young lad that was sitting on the street corner, hitting himself on the head with the hammer. And he said it felt good after he stopped. I, too, along with Donna, would like to thank all you wonderful people here for my sobriety and my sanity. And I would like to leave a little thought with you that I had read somewhere, and it has helped me very, very much. And it goes something like this. It is far better to light a little candle rather than curse the darkness. And may God bless each and every one of us. Thank you.
I'm sure you will all agree that step two could not have had a better presentation. Thank you very much, Ralph.